Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on Monday, April 23rd, 2012. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com every Monday live from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time and from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. And remember that our shows are archived on DrSaputo.com and on PRN.FM.
Today you're going to hear Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after the hour and 22 the hour. And we got a great show for you today that's going to include how cruciferous vegetables are linked to breast cancer survival, maybe better than chemotherapy.
We're finally going to get to that and to how low calcium intake increases the risk of kidney stones.
Yeah, that sounds backwards, doesn't it? And the stool, our precious stool, is worth its weight in gold if you look at it as a potent microbial organ.
And not the one you sit on.
That's true.
And does cholesterol prevent cancer?
And how about adding proton pump inhibitors to NSAIDs? Is that really a smart idea? You get a two for one there.
And revising school nutrition standards will actually lower health costs.
And if we got time, we'll go into MDs fail to promote prevention and how naturopathy can blend in and do a lot more. So if you want to join us in our conversation, you got questions about our topics or your health, give us a call. The number is 888-874-4888.
Well, the topic of cruciferous vegetables isn't really a new one, but eating cruciferous vegetables after breast cancer diagnosis in a current study showed that it was associated with improved survival, and the results even showed superior values to conventional treatment with chemo, radiation, and surgery. So let's remind people what cruciferous vegetables are.
Let's remind people about Hippocrates, too, and he said, let food be your medicine and medicine be your food. The guy 2,500 years ago was right on the mark. So what you're talking about is those vegetables like cabbage and bok choy and greens and broccoli and Brussels sprouts.
I mean, turnips. And
there's a whole lot of them that are really very good to help prevent cancer. You know, in people who have stage 4 cancer, we extend life in about 2% of those people using mainstream therapies. That is a shockingly bad number. When you do things and you're comparing now all stages of cancer, 1 through 4, and you're using cruciferous vegetables as a treatment for cancer, you're looking at somewhere between a 27 and 62% decrease in mortality. That is impressive, and it really just strikes me that when we're doing things that are natural, we're living a healthy lifestyle, we're living close to nature, we're doing what we should be and what we're intended to do when we were put on this planet, things work out.
And you know what else is weird is when you think about some of the conventional treatments, a lot of them are causing what you're trying to prevent. It's like you're trading one cancer for another. We know that chemotherapy is carcinogenic and so is radiation.
Wouldn't it be nice to just use something called food? I mean, the whole lifestyle that we live in is so important. You look at things like sunshine, you know, getting your vitamin D and lowering the risk for a lot of cancers like prostate, breast, and colon, or getting exercise. It reduces our risk for getting cancer because that's how we detoxify.
And eating an alkaline diet, which would include those cruciferous vegetables.
Absolutely, is a great thing because our pH is very important in determining whether or not our body can defend itself against cancer,
you know,
and every other disease as well.
There are also some other foods that are good for reducing your risk of cancer, like high lignin flaxseed oil. That's supposed to decrease the risk of breast cancer.
Well, and it also helps in people who have prostate cancer. You know, the ASCO, the American Society for Clinical Oncology, a few years ago, that was the big breakthrough for the year. We're talking about how flaxseed oil would make people who have prostate cancer live longer.
So when you're looking at the flaxseed oil, look at the highest lignin flaxseed oil. That's the brown stuff that's at the bottom of the bottle.
So when you think it's the scummy stuff, it's the good stuff.
So when you buy that flaxseed oil, shake it up so that you get that brown stuff in there and keep that flaxseed oil in the refrigerator also. You know, another thing that I've heard about that a lot of people use, and I haven't read a particular study on it or anything, but is wheatgrass. I used to know, have a friend who had a friend that had cancer, and not only did she drink the wheatgrass, but she gave herself enemas with it. And it seemed like it turned out that it took care of it. The last I heard, she was in relapse anyway. She didn't have any more signs of the cancer. And I think, do they do something with the wheatgrass at the Gerson Clinic, or that's just
No, they didn't.
No,
I went down to the Gerson Clinic maybe, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago just to see what they were doing because I heard so much about it. They were more into coffee enemas than anything else because, that you know, coffee is an amazing substance. It's a choleretic agent, Vicki, which means that it stimulates the secretion of bile. And what's bile? Of course, it's good to digest our food, our fats, particularly because it emulsifies fats. But more importantly, it's what detoxifies the body. It's what the liver secretes that's got toxins in it that go into the gut. Now, when you take a coffee enema, what happens? You wind up getting a lot of diarrhea promoted from it, which is exactly what you want from a choleretic agent. Because if you're putting all these toxins into the colon, coming from the liver and the rest of the body, you can't get them out fast enough because otherwise they'll reabsorb. Just like when we exercise and we sweat and we have all these toxins coming out of our body, they dry on the skin and they go right back in the body unless we take a shower.
Well, I know that the people at the Gerson Clinic used to look forward to what they called their quote-unquote coffee break.
Yeah, well, I didn't do my coffee breaks the way they did. I like it the other way, but maybe that's because I don't have cancer, at least not yet that I know of. So this whole business of what do you do to try and promote cancer to disappear, you know, we're talking about sunlight, exercise, alkalinization. There are some immune boosters that do things, too, things like modified citrus pectin and some of the maitake and shiitake mushrooms do a wonderful job at trying to boost natural killer cell function. We also know that people who have a problem with not enough sleep have a higher risk of developing cancer and actually most other diseases. When the American Cancer Society, doing one of the few good things it's done over the last 50 years, they did a study in the late 50s that showed that people who got less than 4 hours of sleep had a higher risk for all kinds of mortality that included cancer than any other risk factor that it looked at that included smoking and lack of exercise.
Well, when people
and stress
brag about not needing much sleep, that's not a good thing to be bragging about.
Okay. Well,
but also the other thing is that eating sugar, because cancer cells love sugar.
Well, they do. And it gets pretty complicated because the whole business of cancer and its treatment is now getting very, very complicated as we're learning more about it. And what we're finding is that fat is a very good thing to give cancer cells, but it needs to be the right kind of fat. It should be saturated coconut oils because they help stimulate the mitochondria, the cancer cells, producing enough energy that that cell may actually transform back into a normal cell.
But on the other side of that, if a person is overweight or obese, the toxins are stored in their fat cells.
Well, that's right. And so, I mean, there's just a lot of factors to look into there.
And stress is another
thing. Stress is huge, and it's a disease. It's an epigenetic disease.
Well, then think about our environment.
Well, that's what epigenetics is about.
Yeah.
You're exactly right. So the real issue is cancer something that's caused by genes, or is it caused by what we do to those genes when we expose them to things in the environment? And all these lifestyle factors that we're talking about, the answers are clear. It's epigenetic, meaning that it's not caused by genes. You know, I've many times in this show talked about Dean Ornish's work in prostate cancer that he published a few years ago. And what he did is he took people who had Gleason 6 prostate cancer, which is a cancer that's not very serious, meaning that, say, at age 60, 60% of men already have it, but they're not going to die from it except in about 2% of the cases. So in those people who you can watch and wait because it's safe to do that and the complications of the treatment may be worse than just following to see who does well and who doesn't, when he took 300 of those patients and he took half of them and he biopsied their prostates and he tested 500 oncogenes, those cancer genes that we have, they were turned on. He re-biopsied them after doing nothing to that 150 people 3 months later, and what he found was is that those oncogenes were still turned on. But in the other 150, they did yoga, they did meditation, they were on a healthy diet, they did exercise, they reduced their stress. Then he re-biopsied them at 3 months. The 500 oncogenes, for the most part, were turned off. So we're looking at the effects of the environment on our DNA and genes as being far more important than our genetics, because DNA is not fixed in its structure. It can be changed a lot.
This is where we need to really encourage prevention.
Oh, for sure. And so the kinds of things we're talking about here are huge. Okay, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Lynn Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. I guess we have a call from Cameron from New York. Hi, Cameron.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
Terrific. I just heard you talking about the wheatgrass. I grow it myself in my house, and I have a couple of shots each day.
Oh, good for you.
It's wonderful. But the two places where they use it for therapy are the Hippocrates Health Institute down in Florida.
Indeed.
And then also the Ann Wigmore Institute in Puerto Rico. And both of those places are just wonderful. I went to the one in Puerto Rico, which is much less expensive than the one in Florida. You go and, you know, you learn how to make wheatgrass, and you learn about the properties of it, and you stay there, and it's just a wonderful place.
Do you know if they consider that a cruciferous vegetable?
No, I'm sure it's not.
No, it's a grass.
Right.
So it's a grain.
Right. So
what
was the benefit that you could tell by taking it? Did you feel differently, or do you have...
No. I've been taking it for so long now that I don't, you know, really notice it. I've just been I've just been doing it for so long. But you know, I'm 57. I'm in great health. You know,
good.
I have nothing wrong with me. Everyone's always saying, "Why do you have so much energy?" And you know,
your voice sounds like you have a lot of energy.
It sure does.
I think it's because of the wheatgrass, and also I'm totally you know, vegetarian. And you know, I just think the wheatgrass just feels great when it just goes through your veins. It just feels great.
Well, that's great. It's good that you do that.
Yeah.
I have a lot of good things to say about the Institute that you're talking about. They do some good work. And I think
really
a lot
do.
Of people who have diseases that are chronic diseases would be smart to do the important lifestyle and preventive things and the recovery things that they have there. So thanks for the call, Cameron.
You're welcome.
You have a great day.
Bye.
All right, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Lynn Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
Okay, you know, it's been thought that people with a history of kidney stones should decrease their calcium intake. But a new study shows that it's just the opposite, that consuming adequate calcium may actually help prevent kidney stones, and if you decrease the calcium, it may even be dangerous. So how does this work?
Well, that's interesting. You know, in the April issue of the Journal of Urology of this year, 2012, women with kidney stones were found to have a higher absorption rate of calcium. Isn't that interesting? Meaning that we all consume a certain amount of calcium in our diet, but the percent that we absorb varies depending on who you are, what your genetics are, and how much calcium you take in. And what they found in 5,400 patients, of which 500 had a history of stones, no matter how much calcium they took in, the fractional calcium absorption, that's the amount of calcium that you eat that's actually absorbed, was higher if you had a kidney of stone, if you had a history of kidney stones. So what seems to be important here is that we turn down the actual amount of calcium that we absorb. So if we lower the fractional calcium absorption by increasing the amount that's in our diet, then we're going to take in a lower percentage. And we take in somewhere between, oh, I'd say 30 and 70% of the calcium that we eat in our body as an average. And most people probably absorb about 30%. So it's interesting that it's just the reverse of what you think, because most people who have kidney stones, the first thing they think is, I got to get the calcium out of my diet because there's too much calcium there. And that calcium, if there's less of it, it's going to have less of an effect. But when you look at the net absorption overall, it's less if you take in more calcium, either by your diet or by supplements. And there's a lot of conflicting evidence that's out there that's very interesting that tells us about calcium and how it works. We thought for years that you could have all the calcium you want in your diet, but if you took it in supplements, it was worse. And that's one of the things about research. One week it says one thing, the next week it says something else, and you can never be sure So a lot of time has passed, and a lot of studies have been done. So I think that we get caught between a rock and a hard place, not knowing what to do. If you have a problem with kidney stones, probably your best bet at this point in time is eat a normal amount of calcium. Don't go overboard with it, because that causes problems too, particularly if you have osteoporosis. A lot of people are taking up to 2 grams a day of calcium, and the calcium is not just going back in our bones, it's also going into our soft tissues. So it's not just a matter of kidney stones, not just a matter of osteoporosis. It's a matter of overall calcium balance in the body and where it goes. So it makes it very interesting. Anyway, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Lynn Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. We'll get back to your calls after Vicki's first 2020 tip.
I'm going to tell you some shocking truths about certified organic. You know, so many of us have switched to organic because we want to be protected. We want to eat healthy food, especially when the label says certified organic, then we don't have to worry about it being contaminated by pesticides and GMOs or other chemicals. But, you know, do we? Organic farmers and food manufacturers are spending a lot of money to gain organic certification, which means that the food or the ingredients been grown according to strict uniform standards. And yet, organic food can still be contaminated. It isn't supposed to contain GMOs, but you know what happens? There's this thing called a drift or cross-pollination, and you can find GMOs in organic milk and baby formula, according to a report by the Cornucopia Institute. And then when you think about it, if baby formula can be contaminated, is anything else safe? The U.S. National Organic Standards Board permits GM soil, fungus, and algae to be used as a nutritional supplement in food, and that kind of tinkering with the standards actually defeats the whole purpose of organic. When you think about it, GMOs are linked to health problems, despite the government's, you know, refusing to conduct long-term clinical human trials. We know that they're not safe because within 3 generations of rats that are fed a diet containing GM food, they'll die out. So it makes you kind of wonder about the falling fertility rates in humans, doesn't it?
Sure does.
And then thousands of livestock have died from ingesting plants that are genetically modified. Just think about, you know, corn-fed beef, for example. I mean, what's it doing to us? And then the genetically engineered foods damage the immune response in animal experiments. And think about all the autoimmune diseases that we've been hearing about in humans. It's really skyrocketed, especially where a lot of GMOs are in the food supply. And then as soon as GM soy was permitted in the UK, soy allergies increased by 50%. And in animal experiments, GM foods caused damage to kidneys, testicles, the stomach, the liver, the pancreas, and more. I mean, what's it doing to our internal organs? And when people consume GM soy, which is in over 80% of packaged foods, the genetically modified material infiltrates the gut bacteria. And if you've listened to our shows, you know how important that is. And that continues to alter its function. So this is something that we really seriously need to be thinking about. I mean, if organic food is accidentally contaminated to a certain threshold, it's still allowed to be labeled as organic. And the reasoning from these certified organic people that are like the bureaucrats in that department, they say that certified organic refers to the process, not the end result. So if a food's accidentally contaminated, it can still be labeled organic. And that's when I was talking about, you know, how we need to think about the cross-contamination. And farmers aren't required by law to test each harvest for GMO contaminations. And, you know, it just sounds to me like the best way to go is to grow your own food with non-GMO seeds, and if you can find them, and hope that we don't get this drift in cross-pollination. I found a good way to do it, too, is to go to some of these farmers markets, because I think that there's been so much talk about organic and that the people are just demanding organic food, that now these big companies are starting to manufacture organic food, and that's when you start getting into trouble, is when it becomes big business, because then it becomes about money. And a lot of these smaller farmers can't afford to get the certified organic the certification, and the large companies, of course, can afford to do that. But then they start yanking around some of the rules and tinkering with them, like I was mentioning. So something just to be aware of.
You got a good point there. That's really important stuff, Vicki. You never really know what you got until you've studied it and gone a lot of layers deeper. And a lot of the time, I'm just shocked at what happens. Anyway, this is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. And we have a call from Flory. Flory, how are you doing? Are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. How are you?
Yes, thank you for the show. It's the first time I'm on this show.
Well, it's nice to have you.
Yeah, thank you. I have a background of history of breast cancer.
Uh-huh.
And 6 years ago, I had chemo, radiation, the whole thing.
Uh-huh.
And I am in remission for 5 years.
Uh-huh.
Now, I live a very healthy life. I spent all my money eating organic, exercise, take tons of supplements, juicing lemon, dandelion, cinnamon.
Uh-huh.
I don't do animal protein nor dairy.
Uh-huh.
But I do a lot of soy. And I also, talking about calcium, I take magnesium for absorption and 4,000 of milligrams of calcium a day.
Yeah.
Now, my question is this. How safe is to take so many supplements a day plus a soy with the breast cancer background? And I also developed osteoporosis, and I take for breast cancer prevention Arimidex and Reclast, the injection. Now, the Arimidex aggravates the osteoporosis, and I would like, after 5 years of taking it, to get off.
Yeah.
But since I was BRCA positive, I had a very aggressive cancer, and I also have estrogen sensitive, I am afraid of recurrence if I let go of that, and the osteoporosis getting worse if I let go of the Reclast.
Yeah,
so I'm a little bit puzzled here.
Well, you've asked me a lot of questions here that are very complex, but I'll do my best to answer each of them. First of all, welcome to the U.S. Indonesia is a beautiful place. Vicki and I have spent a couple of vacations there playing tennis at the Borobudur. You know where that is. Oh, from Venezuela. I thought you said Indonesia. Venezuela. Well, Caracas is a good place, too. We played a little tennis there as well. But anyway, back to your good questions here. If you have the BRCA genes, have you had both breasts removed?
Yes, and the hysterectomy as well.
Okay, that's good that that's happened, because the incidence of breast cancer in that setting by the time you're 80 years old is probably 80 to 90%. The chemotherapy and radiation and surgery are over with now, except for the Arimidex, which you're still on. When you're taking soy products, you're probably fighting that a bit, because the soy has it has estrogens in it that are probably not a good idea, and particularly if it's not organic, because of all the problems that have to do with the pesticides that are on it. But guessing you're probably on the organic, knowing you. Calcium may be an advantage for people who have cancer, but I don't think that calcium in the dose of 2 grams a day is a wise thing to do. It's something that will lead to problems with arteriosclerosis, probably, especially in the setting of osteoporosis. So I would go more to natural things. I would get as much sunlight as you can. In the daytime between 10 and 2, as long as you don't burn your skin, and you should have nice dark skin if you're from Venezuela. So maybe 45 minutes or an hour a day to try and boost up those vitamin D levels. Find out what your vitamin D levels are. Have them measured. And then see if you can keep yours in the range of 70 to maybe 90. Because
I take a lot of, like, 5,000 IU of vitamin D, and I'm very white, by the way.
Okay, all right. Well, vitamin D at 5,000 IUs a day is not a lot. For someone who has cancer and you'd like to stay in the higher ranges of that, what you need to do is make sure that you're measuring your vitamin D level. Measure your 25-hydroxy vitamin D3 level and see what that shows. The Reclast, I understand the use of. That's something to try, and it's a bisphosphonate. I'm not a big fan of that, but I am a big fan of the vitamin D, the vitamin K. And I would take about 15. I'm not giving you advice. I'm giving you information to consider with your doctor.
Yes.
You may want to be taking vitamin K in a dose of about 15 milligrams, so long as you don't have a problem with coagulation that's induced by something like Coumadin. Otherwise,
I was taking it.
You are taking Coumadin?
He took me off the vitamin K because he said that I have tendency to clog and it's dangerous.
Well, are you on Coumadin?
No.
If you're not on warfarin or Coumadin, vitamin K does not make your blood clot, and you probably should be considering the use of nattokinase, which is a very important anticoagulant, along with a little bit of fish oil. And you should have a live blood cell analysis done, if you can, to try and assess what the state of your coagulation is, because people who have cancer very often have hypercoagulation, which causes a spread of the cancer to be more aggressive. So there's a lot going on here, and I can't really do justice to this in a five-minute answer. So I hope what I've told you has helped you and will guide you to try and figure out what direction you want to move in, but do that with a good doctor that understands nutritional medicine, understands complementary and alternative approaches to treating cancer and the mainstream approaches to cancer. So thanks for calling.
And if you've missed any of this, these shows are all archived, so you can go back and listen to it again.
Right. I'd also suggest you go to my website at drsaputo.com. It's drsaputo.com. And there's a lot of information on how to manage cancer there if you take our health assessments there. The health assessments are free. In fact, joining the site is mandatory if you want to get to the health assessments, but they don't cost a penny. They're all free, and there are 33 health assessments there for all the conditions you can imagine that are common. And they take about 3 minutes to fill out, and they have tons of information. We have 2,000 audios and videos there that are all linked to the condition that we're talking about. So that would be your next step, I think, that would help you. So thanks for calling. All right, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888, and we'll be back taking your calls after a short station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. We're going to go right back to calls. We have a call from Marlon in New Jersey. Hi, Marlon.
How are you?
How are you doing?
Very good.
Good. What's up?
I enjoy your shows. They're very informative.
Well, thank you.
And my question is, I have an organic herb garden, many different herbs. And,
great.
The warm winter, I've had an abundance of organic hyssop growing already. And I would like to know what medicinal purposes can I use it for and how can I cook it?
Well, first of all, I don't know that much about hyssop, but so maybe you're going to educate me. I know that it's used in a lot of drinks, okay, things like absinthe and some others. It's used ritually in Catholicism as a ceremonial herb. But its medical uses, I think, I'm not aware of. I think if you take too much of it, it's a problem.
Okay.
So tell me about it.
Well, I grew it for colds, for the throat, gargling with it and whatnot, for the wintertime. I heard that was very good.
Huh. I'm not aware of that.
And so, and for the bees, of course, to pollinate everything else. The bees love it.
That's great.
So I just wanted to know, like I said, I have an abundance of it this year, and
yeah.
I really didn't want it to go to waste, and I was wondering what I could use it for.
Well, I think it's time to do a Google search, my friend, because I'm not going to be able to help you there. I'm not an herbalist, but I know some things about some of the herbs that we use in medicine. This one I don't know about, so I'll be looking that up myself, and maybe next week we can talk a bit about it.
Very good. Thank you, and keep up the good work.
Hey, thanks for calling, Marlon.
Thanks for taking care of the bees.
Right.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. The number is 888 874 888-344-8888. We have a call from Donald from Georgia. Hi, Donald.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm good. What's up?
Look, I have an autoimmune disease.
What is it?
I have myasthenia.
Myasthenia
gravis.
Yes, I know. Okay, and your question is what?
I was wondering what kind of foods or supplements can I take along with the medicine that they're giving me?
Well, first of all, any autoimmune disease is one where, just for our listeners, where the antibody system in our body has gone haywire. And we make too many antibodies as opposed to too many cells that are involved in immunity. There are two kinds of immune defenses, at least, that the body has. One is making antibodies, and the other is making cells. They're called natural killer cells or T cells. In your condition, you have an abundance of antibodies, and we would like to try and quiet them down so that the antibodies that you're making that are attacking your own conditions that are causing the own condition that's causing myasthenia could be quieted down. There are some ways you can do that. One is to use vitamin D, because vitamin D is an amazing hormone vitamin that is able to shift the production from making lots of antibodies to making more of the cells that the body needs to defend itself, particularly against viruses and cancers. So,
and, I had a physical just 2 weeks ago, and my doctor told me that I have enough vitamin D.
Well, what was the number?
I think it was around 80 or something like that.
Then you're probably taking some vitamin D as a supplement, is that right?
Right.
Okay, well, you've done the first thing that's good. Sometimes in my patients, and you can discuss this with your own doctor because I can't give you advice, just information to talk to your doctor about, I'll use a dose of 50,000 units every other day or sometimes a day in an effort to shift over that tendency for antibodies to be made in large amounts.
How many days would you do that?
Well, in my patients, I monitor their ionized calcium, their serum calcium, and their parathyroid hormone, and their kidney function to make sure that we're not getting into trouble. So it gets complicated and it varies with each person. So you need to have a doctor who understands this and is willing to give it a try. And in your condition, where medicines are not going to solve the problem entirely, but they're going to help to some extent, you're looking for everything that you can.
Right.
The other thing you can do is make sure that you live as healthy a lifestyle as you possibly can. You know, we tend to think of, well, when the horse is out of the barn, you've got something like myasthenia or some other disease that's very difficult to manage, that it's too late for that. But that's not right. So what we eat, you know, having an alkaline diet and having lots of fruits and vegetables and herbs and spices are a really important thing to do.
I'm eating a lot of broccoli and spinach, raw spinach.
Well, all the green leafy vegetables are good, and I think eating mostly vegetables, you could even try juicing.
Yes.
You know, doing the Gerson style of juicing where you've got a really good press juicer and juicing maybe 10 pounds of vegetables a day to make just 3 or 4 8-ounce glasses would be something that would support anybody's health back to wellness insofar as you can.
Because then the nutrients are so concentrated.
Exactly. It's the best nutrition that you can get on the planet.
Right.
So that would be good. And then getting enough sleep, getting exercise the best that you can, even though you're going to have limitations because of your weakness, do what you can. You may want to do some imagery. That can be helpful to boost immunity and to boost just what you think about what's happening. That has a powerful effect on our biochemistry and physiology. This is one of those diseases we don't have any great answers for.
Yes.
But these are the kinds of things that I would focus on the most, Donald, if I were you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
Good luck with all that,
yeah,
Donald.
Yeah, have a good day. Okay, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo. The lines are open at 888-874-4888. Okay, Vicki, what's up for our next agenda here?
Well, I think it's about time for my 2020 tip.
Oh, you're right. Okay, so we'll be back taking your calls after Vicki's final 2020 tip.
Well, since there's no music here, I'll just get right into it. I wanted to continue on about organic foods because... here we go.
Go ahead.
Okay, I wanted to continue on about organic foods because If the genetically engineered organisms were just magically eradicated overnight, certified organic food would still not be as pure and healthy as you'd expect because of some of the legal sleight of hand that allows dangerous toxins to leach into your organic food, like food processing aids or chemicals that are permitted by law to come into contact with organic foods. And most have not been tested for safety. But one has been tested, and we've talked about it before, and I know you've heard about it, and that's the BPA, the bisphenol A, and it's used in food packaging, even for organic products, and it leaches into a lot of the foods that it comes in contact with, and BPA is linked to infertility, hormonal disruptions, cancer, insulin resistance, birth defects. You know, and despite this overwhelming evidence, the FDA decided not to ban the use of BPA in any food packaging, including organics. You know, we're in need of healing our whole culture because of all this that's going on. And as our health deteriorates from poor quality and from GMO-laden, chemical-infested food, our population declines due to all this impaired fertility and genetic damage. And so it's time for us to talk with our pocketbooks and with our votes and to try to discourage any of this from being allowed. You know, I can remember when not so long ago that we were allowed to drink raw organic milk. But one of my frustrations is when I'd go to the health food store and I'd look for the raw organic milk, they'd have two different kinds. The organic raw milk was in a plastic container. And the raw milk that wasn't organic was in a glass bottle.
Isn't that awesome?
And I'd stand there thinking, eeny, meeny, miny, moe. Which is the best way to go? So.
Exactly. Well, that's a good point. That's a great tip, Vicki. Thanks for that. All right, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. We have a call from Clarence from the Bronx. Hi, Clarence. How you doing?
Oh, I'm all right. How you doing, Doctor? I listen to your show. I listen to Gary Noel, and I always turn the TV, radio off after Gary Noel. But today I listen to you guys, and I like your show. It sounds, you know, it's really great. They don't have shows like this anywhere, you know.
Well, thanks, Clarence. Appreciate that.
But tell your
friends about it.
I will. I tell a lot of people about it, but I always sound like a kook, you know, because they're into, like, they drink sodas and they eat McDonald's and,
right.
You know, I'm like the oddball guy.
They think you're a health food nut.
Yeah,
huh?
And I'm a health food nut. You know, I like carrot juice and all that stuff.
But, that a boy.
But my problem is that I had a problem, like, I used to get these attacks at night, and I'm like about 4 years ago. And I had a really bad attack, and they thought it was my heart. They thought I was having a heart attack.
Right.
Ambulance came and took me to the hospital, and they said I had gallstones.
Yeah.
So after about a year of me fighting with the doctors, they finally took my gallbladder out. So I found out later that I could have took applesauce that could have probably healed my gallbladder. I didn't know that. So now I don't have a gallbladder, and I hear about the liver, and Gary Noel said to take lemon water to help clean out the liver, and I try to do everything to help my liver. So what could I do now that I don't have a gallbladder? Is my life expectancy shorter now, or what can I do?
No. There's a lot of things you can do about it. But first, I'd just like to point out that in medicine, we do a lot of things that are pretty aggressive that sometimes don't have a lot of basis for it. Like, for example, a lot of the times when we did surgery on people in their abdomen, they do what's called an incidental appendectomy. Mm-hmm. Which means as long as you're there, take the appendix out because it doesn't do anything. Mm-hmm. Well, BS. It does a ton. And we now know that the appendix has, well, at least a few of us know what it does. Mm-hmm. It's actually a storage place for probiotics, okay, for those microbes that live in the gut. In a blind sack that continually oozes out these probiotics and a lot of chemicals in there that help us to maintain a normal GI tract. Then we have the business about, well, the gallbladder, maybe we could do without it because it only collects stones and it helps a little bit with digestion, but it does a lot, and it makes a lot of hormones that are important as well.
Mm-hmm.
So when you don't have a gallbladder, what happens is bile just oozes out from the liver as it's made. It's not stored in the gallbladder. And then when you eat, you don't put those fat emulsifying enzymes in there to be able to digest fat like you'd like to. So what you could do is you could use some bile salts or some emulsifying agents that you could get at your health food store, and maybe even some fat digestive enzymes, and that you could do when you eat.
Well,
you
know, one thing, doctor, a couple years before that, I was really overweight. I lost a lot of weight because I found out that I had my pressure was up.
Yeah.
I had like pressure.
Sure.
And I started to I cut back on anything with salt, and I watched like I don't drink milk. I drink a soy milk. They make an Eden soy milk that has like 5% salt. It has a little bit of fat in it. So I don't really eat anything with salt in it. I try not to use any kind of salt because of the pressure. So now you're saying I should use salt?
Are you talking about soy or salt?
Salt.
Salt. I thought you said.
I thought you said you were using soy. No.
Yeah,
okay. Salt is not. And I well.
You
first
said,
of all,
you said bile salts.
Bile salts. That's not just
bile salt. Okay.
That's different. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I don't think anybody should eat salt. It's poison, toxic stuff.
Yeah.
Sea salt is another story.
It's called
it has
B-salt?
A lot of micronutrients in it, and so I would never use sodium chloride that you buy at the grocery store. I would always use sea salt. But for you, what you need is to be able to have the bile when you're eating.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way to get that is to buy those products I told you about, and then when you eat, use them. Because fats are healthy and they're good for us, particularly if you eat the right ones, especially the essential fatty acids, and a high quality olive oil might be good. The saturated fats, olive oil is good. Coconut oil is very good.
I use that as well.
Well, you're on the ball, Clarence.
Oh well, so you said I'm sorry, Doc. I know you're really busy, and you're a great show, and it's helpful to so many people. But I just wanted to know. You said what kind of salt? Now, bile salt. I should use
bile salts. Okay, those are things that emulsify fat, and if you don't emulsify fat, you can't make it in small enough particles that you can absorb it, and it just goes out, and it'll give you diarrhea.
Yeah.
So you want to go to your health food store and get something that will help you digest fats and take that with your meals, Clarence. So thanks for calling.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Okay.
You too.
Take
bye.
Care.
Okay, bye-bye. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Lynn Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
You know, we were talking about calcium and kidney stones, and we never really did quite finish up on that. And I just wanted to say that according to this study that was done, they said that while many patients are told to increase their fluid intake to dilute the blood after they've had a kidney stone, that the doctors should also advise patients to cut down on their salt intake and eat less animal protein and be sure to get adequate calcium.
Yeah, well, you want to have an alkaline diet for sure. Whenever you have an acid diet, it makes calcium less soluble. And when you're taking in salt, for every molecule of sodium you take out, you're going to excrete one molecule of calcium. So it's something that Vicki's made a good point on.
And it's also important for patients to take their calcium with meals.
It's better that way so that we can bind some of that calcium that we would be absorbing when we're getting too much. So it's interesting. The whole business of calcium gets very confusing. And that's why mega doses or not enough are what you should avoid. And taking just the right amount, and that depends on who you are. What you need is a doctor that understands nutrition. Good luck.
We also have a nutritionist that's on our website, drsaputo.com, where you can get a free 15-minute consultation.
No, that's true. If you go to our shop, okay, that has products in it, and we use the Designs for Health products, they are linked to our health assessments. So that we have 33 health assessments that talk about heart disease, cancer, cholesterol, diabetes, anything you can think of, that take about 3 minutes to take. And what comes back when you take these assessments is information that's in audio and video. They're short little bites, and I've made most all of them myself or with Vicki. We will give you information that will educate you about the kinds of things that you can do so that you can manage those problems the best and safest way. When you go to your doctor, you're not going to get that. What you're going to get is a bunch of drugs that suppress symptoms most of the time. And sometimes that's what you need to do, but most of the time, that's not the case.
And we believe in an integrative approach. So.
Absolutely. Okay.
Well, recently we talked about fecal transplantation as a treatment for C. difficile.
Boy, doesn't that sound weird. And what are you talking about, taking stool from one person and putting it in the colon of another? Ugh, that sounds awful.
Well, here's a study showing that the microflora in the gut may have a role in causing type 2 diabetes and also related liver disease that people can get with diabetes.
Isn't that
and
something?
So guess what the treatment is that they recommend.
That's right.
That's it.
So you get it. Here's what the study was that they did. They had a 16-week study that took two groups of germ-free mice. These are mice that are raised in an environment where there are no microbes. And when they're raised in an environment like that, there are no microbes in the gut either. Okay? So you have a sterile GI tract. However, if they transplant the stool from a mouse that has type 2 diabetes and this fatty liver problem, guess what? The mice develop that disease themselves. So what we're looking at is the importance of the microflora of the gut, which is really important in managing how we will do with our health.
It's like its own organ, isn't it?
It's absolutely an organ. It's called a microbial organ. It's got more metabolic activity than any organ system in the body. And strange as it may sound, and I dare you to try this, but it's worth its weight in gold to you. But I don't think anybody else is going to buy it from you.
What, to sell your poop?
Well, that's what's happening here.
If you're healthy.
Well, that's what's happening here. You know, we don't appreciate the tremendous importance of the role that this microbial organ plays in our life, because it's the interface between our internal and external world. And it's really what I would call an adaptational organ that is constantly adapting to help us to connect with our environment in a way that's healthy for us. There are about 1,000 different kinds of microbes, different species of microbes that live in the gut, and a very complex ecosystem that functions to do a lot of things for us that are helpful. So, for example, it metabolizes hormones, carcinogens. It can help make vitamins K, B5, B6, and biotin. It produces butyrate, which is a major metabolic fuel of the colon. It boosts immunity. So these are things that really are important. It also crowds out other kinds of pathogenic bacteria, like the C. difficile and others that can cause real problems with our health, even the candida.
And also the gut plays a large role in allergies and candida. And you talk about a lot of these things in a couple of books that you've edited and that you've contributed several chapters to. One of them is called Optimal Digestive Health, and the other one's called Boosting Immunity.
Right. Well, it's this is stuff that's important that most of us don't know about, but it's really important to recognize. So it seems silly that the stool in our body is underappreciated when you look at it, but then, I mean, who really wants to study it? It's not the most attractive thing in life. And if you've got any kind of problem with your bowel, whether it be ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease or irritable bowel syndrome or an infection, there are such wonderful, valuable tests that can be done that can help us to manage some of those diseases by manipulating how we feed the gut and what we avoid putting in it. So there's a whole lot here that is important for maintaining normal health. Well, we're near the end of the show, and I want to remind you that we'll be back to talk live about what's new in the news and health and take your health questions every Monday afternoon on PRN.FM and drsaputo.com from 1 to 2 Eastern Time and 10 to 11 Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health is also archived in drsaputo.com as well as PRN.FM.
And if you've enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics that we discussed, go to drsaputo.com and check out our fast track videos located on drsaputo.com under radio. And remember that lifestyle is the most important, powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
Have a great week. We'll see you next week.